Welcome to Purdue Crop Chat, a regular podcast from Hoosier Ag Today and the Purdue University Extension Service, featuring Purdue Extension soybean specialist Dr. Sean Castile and Extension corn specialist Dr. Dan Quinn. On this episode, Dan and Sean discuss weeds with special guest Purdue Extension weed scientist, Dr. Tommy Butts.
The main thing is we just need to keep that sprayer as close to the planter as possible, which gets to be difficult when you have hot temps and high winds, which is great for drying out the soil to plant. That's not great for spraying when we've got high winds, right? Unless you want to share with your neighbor.
This podcast is made possible by the Indiana Corn Marketing Council and Indiana Soybean Alliance. Your Indiana corn and soybean checkoff investments are working to find new markets for your crops through international demand, new uses, and research. Learn more about the programs working on your behalf at yourcheckoff.org. Now your host for Purdue Crop Chat, Hoosier Ag Today's Eric Pfeiffer.
We're back on the Purdue Crop Chat from the Indiana Corn and Soybean Innovation Center in West Lafayette. Eric Pfeiffer here, Dan Corn Quinn here to my left. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Eric.
Soybean Sean Castile right across from me. I have to look at him this whole time. My goodness.
You are just a privileged man, aren't you?
And you know, he even got here earlier than I did today. I don't know. I'm afraid that, like, again, there's going to be like the can with the snakes popping out at me, that he was here early to set up the prank of some kind.
That's right. Just don't shake my hand. I got the buzzer, right?
Yeah, I know. I'm afraid like my seat's going to come out from under me here at some point. I don't know what's going to happen.
Whole lot of love here.
He'll write that in his diary tonight.
Okay, sounds good.
You were here first.
It's going to be in the journal. Yeah.
Once a year.
Yeah. And Tommy Butts is here. Tommy, if you listen to this podcast regularly, you'll know that I don't do a whole lot of research or preparedness ahead of time. I don't even know your title. I just know you work with weeds.
That's good enough. You know, weed scientist. So it's something to deal with weeds and killing them, right?
Okay.
So. Killing weeds. Okay. As long as we've clarified which weed we're talking about.
There's
okay.
Weeds in that crop, though, too.
Okay. So, you know. Okay. Ooh, we can go down that avenue.
It's a big money maker, my home state.
It's a cash crop,
yeah,
no doubt.
Cash crop, in my home state. Yeah.
You would also, if you listen to this podcast regularly, that I'm one for coming up with nicknames. I don't think I want to go down that road with you, because, quite frankly, I think it would be juvenile, inappropriate.
when does that stop you?
That's right up my alley.
My whole life has been juvenile with the last name of Butts. I'm not sure we're going to get much improved.
I'm going to say there's probably nothing you've never heard. So I'm not going to go there.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, we've got Dan Corn Quinn, Soybean Sean Castile. I think, Darcy, the disease queen's link. I don't think she much cares for that one.
Yeah, probably not.
But I've gone there. I can't just take it back now. So yeah, I think we'll just skip it. I'm gonna take the high road, which again,
the high road. That is
Tom
well
the high road Butts. That's see, I went there. But anyway, Tommy,
this is a heck of a start to this podcast.
I know,
really.
This is just how we do it here on Hoosier Ag Today. Yep. Tommy, we are here to talk about weeds. It's that time. We hear every year, start clean, stay clean. And that's probably easier said than done, right?
Yeah, that's for sure. And it sounds like that already from some phone calls I've gotten between last week trying to get some of our 2 and 3% of our crops in. And then we caught the rain on the weekend. So I've already had some calls of, hey, we got the crop in, then it rained on us. Now we got to wait 2 or 3 days before we can get the sprayer in the field. What do we do now? So we're already seeing that a little bit. But yeah, the more we can keep that sprayer as close to the planter as possible, get our burn downs out, plus get our residuals down, it's where we got to be if we want to have the long-term success all season.
You mentioned, what we got in the ground. USDA did come out with their first update for Indiana on the season. We do have some crops in the ground here. Sean is beaming this morning. That's probably why he got here so early.
The gloat.
It's because soybeans are ahead.
Oh, they always are.
One whole percentage point.
Well, percentage point, but how many acres do we have intended for that state? You know, we're at 5.7 on soy, 5.4 maybe on corn. Yep. So, you know, it works out a little bit more than just that one percentage point. Yeah. I can do the math. I'm doing the math now if you like.
With a calculator.
There's so, an app for that.
So USDA NAS says that we had a whole 3.7 suitable days for field work last week across the state, and farmers were able to get 2% of Indiana's corn crop in the ground and 3% of the state's soybeans.
Or 63,000 more acres than corn. So.
There we go. boy, those degrees really paid off for you, how to use that calculator.
It's the Illinois education coming out.
There we go. Yeah, nationally, we are in decent shape. We're ahead of the pace for both corn and soybeans nationally, a little bit behind the pace for corn here in Indiana. Mm-hmm. You know, we are starting to make some moves here. It's just been wet. It's just been wet throughout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, from corn side, it's, you know, what we've seen, 2% started, and what's interesting is you kind of see it all over the state, right? There's not really one specific area that, you know, I've got calls from people starting to move in northern Indiana all the way down to the Ohio River starting to move as well. So I think some of the southern Indiana folks are in terms of like their timeliness are probably a little bit behind just because they've caught a little bit more rain where the northern Indiana folks have missed some of those rains and they've been actually a little bit ahead up there as well. So, but yeah, we're balls rolling, right? Stuff's moving. We still have plenty of time as well. I always, you know, have that caveat, but yeah, we're off and running. So.
Yeah, you think about last year, we had some Southern Illinois and Indiana growers that were probably pushing late March plantings, and the 21st, 22nd of April, and so just now starting to roll. Same conversation I had not but yesterday, northwest Indiana, we're rolling today. We've got fields that are fit, and so we're getting a lot of trials out, a lot of farmers are going. So I think when you get 75-degree weather and you miss the 2 or 3 inch rains, you can pull the trigger. And honestly, the forecast for this week looks pretty promising. Next week looks really good too. So I think we can cover a lot of ground.
So what does this mean from a weeds standpoint here, Tommy? I mean, you touched on it. It has been wet. Once we do get seeds in the ground and then we get that rain a little bit, it does make it a little bit tougher. What does the strategy need to be here?
Yeah, well, I would say there's a couple strategies I should mention, too, just with the wet weather we've had this spring. So especially in southern Indiana where we had a lot of the flooding and things, it's going to change a little bit for those folks down there. They're probably going to deal with some different weeds that floated in on the floodwaters and stuff that they maybe haven't dealt with before. So we got to watch out for those and try and take care of them in a burn down or something else. It's going to, the heavier soils, you know, it's just going to delay some things and get us behind again, getting that sprayer out there as quick as we need it to be. So in southern Indiana, it'll be, I think, a little bit tough just with the various things that are going to happen with all that flooding. You know, elsewhere in the state, the main thing is we just need to keep that sprayer as close to the planter as possible, which gets to be difficult when you have hot temps and high winds, which is great for drying out the soil to plant. Mm-hmm. That's not great for spraying when we've got high winds, right? Unless you want to share with your neighbor, I guess, the spray.
Well, I think I saw some of that last week. It was all playing the wind, just like a game of horse, right? So, I mean, you already mentioned it, right, that we pushed some plantings last week, that field conditions were fit. Farmers, they were fit. But, I mean, it was 30-mile, 40-mile-an-hour winds. So what do? Are you going to tell a grower that says, I know I've got a yield advantage here and timely planting, but I can't spray? So how do you handle that? You kind of said, here's the problem, but I haven't heard a solution. So what's their solution now that they missed their pre-window?
There really isn't a great solution. That's the like I always say, a weed scientist is the second most negative person in agriculture, right behind an ag economist. Right? So it's where we're at. If there's no good answer.
So we'll invite both, the ag economist and the weed scientist, about mid-June,
It'll be the saddest podcast we've ever done.
Yes. You bring the plant pathologist in there, too. And, yeah. You know, it's just, yep.
You know, I will say, you know, at least in a good chunk of the areas of the state, we have resistance issues, but we're not in dire straits on the resistance front, so we still do have some post-emergence options. So we can get away with it here or there. It's just definitely something you don't want to have to rely on consistently year in and year out or across all your fields, I will say. So, you know, if we're planting, you know, Enlist beans, sure. You know, normally across the vast majority of the state, Enlist is still good, Liberty's still good, Roundup catches our grasses, you know, we can get some overlapping residuals out, like the group 15, stuff like that. On the corn front, you know, atrazine is still a massive player for us across the state. If we can mix it with the bleacher, so Callisto, something like that, man, that combination is awesome. And we get some residual activity on the back end too. So we have options. It's just not near as good, especially for things like water hemp, you know, that just keeps coming at us if we don't get out in front of it.
So walk through a little bit. When we have this nice planting window, but the conditions aren't fit for spraying, and we clearly have seen that, what is that gray area in terms of, okay, normally I like to go ahead of planting, get my pre and residual down, or right after, but it's a day or two. Is that enough of a window? What's really the cutoff in terms of when can I still apply those same kind of chemistries or not? And, it, you know, a day or two doesn't seem like much. Is it because the soybeans or corn, for that matter, have germinated and that's the issue? Or is it, are they starting to crack and that's more of the issue in terms of phytotoxicity? Kind of walk us through that gray area.
Yeah, so it all goes back to crop injury. Right. And so it's varies by herbicide and by label. So we were actually just looking some of this up yesterday for a few different herbicides. But on the soybeans front, for example, Valor on the label has within 3 days of planting, you need to get it out there. And again, that's crop injury concerns either from splash up, right? Mm-hmm. Once they pop out of the ground and you can splash on it if you catch rain after the fact, or if you have an open furrow and you happen to wash all of that Valor in and they have imbibed water and it's just, it bangs them up really hard.
Sure.
So that's part of it. You know, Metribuzin, I think we were looking that one up and that's more like a 5-day requirement. Mm-hmm. And again, it's just basically all in, like you mentioned, right, where that soybean is at, whether it's imbibed water, whether it's you know, germinated, whether it's emerged, that kind of thing, and just the level of injury that we'd see with some of those products then.
So I dare say, let's say we paint the scenario that someone's planted, high winds, and let's say it's dry soil, bone dry soil, and they just really haven't started that germination process. That might, quote, be a little safer if someone was still to pull the trigger versus we just went and we planted last week, good moisture. I checked this morning, 4 days later, we've got the radical already out, you know, a good half an inch. And that's probably like, that's not a good recipe for a spray, even though the beans aren't up out of the ground, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it's all playing that bet. Now I will say extension cap is on right now. Label's the law. We always got to follow the label.
No, so if
the
label states I set you up,
3 days, 5 days, we got to follow that. But that being said, your scenario is 100% right.
Yep.
If it hasn't, you know, soaked up water yet, if it's just sitting there, it's the crop is still safer from that herbicide versus if it swelled and got water in it.
It's all relative, right? You know, you're not guaranteed the whole field's going to be that way, but it's to understand why these labels are set the way they are. 3 to 5 days seems arbitrary if you just think about days, because not every day is the same, but it's about what you talked about,
yes.
A herbicide uptake and the development of the plant and corn, a little more freedom.
For the most part on corn, yeah, there's really not a whole lot, you know, on the pre-emergence side that we get into issues that we can't spray necessarily over the top of corn, too. Yep. So corn generally is safer. There's a couple products out there that we run into some stuff. But for the most part, we're a lot safer on that front.
You know, I was going to ask a little bit on, you know, Sean's documented we've seen this big shift where soybeans, I mean, we have a lot of farmers now that will put 1,000, 2,000 acres of beans in before they even touch corn. Have you noticed, or, you know, seems like soybeans tend to battle the resistant weeds a lot harder than corn does, just with canopy height and stuff like that. Has there been, you know, things to be mindful of, or I guess more issues popping up because of this big shift with earlier planting soybeans now, or things that maybe farmers that, you know, 10 years ago didn't have to deal with and now they need to pay attention to? So just kind of your perspective on, you know, this, we've had pretty big shift in the fact that soybeans are getting planted first, they're, you know, planted a lot earlier. How does that maybe impact the weed control or approaching weed control?
Yeah. Well, and the first thing I would say is I don't know that we know the full effects of some of this early planted soybean yet. You know, we're still kind of on the front end. A lot of that weeds often lag behind a little bit when we're talking about these shifts and things. But it definitely looks like we're going to start seeing some shifts on that front. So, you know, one of the things is we shift soybeans a little bit earlier, and you know, it's tough to control grasses and grass crops and broadleaves and broadleaf crops. And so if we start shifting our soybeans earlier, you can start thinking about some of those early season broadleaves that are going to become a bigger deal, you know, and be more prevalent. So the ragweeds of the world that are early emergers that come out, the horseweed or mare's tails of the world that come that make a comeback because broadleaf and broadleaf crop, and we're pushing it earlier and not getting up, not getting it under control. So that we'll start seeing some shifts on some of that front. The other thing that we have noticed on the earlier planted soybean front that's maybe causing some issues is basically the timing of some of our residual products. So if we shifted earlier, we've gotten so used to spraying residuals for water hemp because that's always our big player. We're trying to get it out there. Well, if we're planting in March, but we really don't have the temperatures for water hemp until May, most of our residuals are played out by that point. And so we're running into these issues where we can't really time the residual like we need to target some of those later emerging weeds. And we've also seen it starting to basically add an extra application because you have a lot longer period of time that they're growing before you get to canopy and things. And so you kind of just need to schedule in your mind that you'll have that second post almost or a third application in there. Or you'll have some late season escapes, which then affects our corn crop in the subsequent year, basically the rotation part of it.
You're listening to Purdue Crop Chat, brought to you by your Indiana Corn and Soybean Checkoff organizations. Visit yourcheckoff.org.
So what are some good rules of thumb? Again, it's a hard thing to say, right? But when you say residuals and how long they last in terms of in the activity zone for weeds that are germinating and emerging, you know, is it rainfall? Is it time? What are some good rules of thumb for people to have in the back of their mind?
I would say the good rule of thumb is there is no rule of thumb.
Okay. rule of pinky then.
Yeah. So it's highly variable depending on, you know, the active ingredient we're talking about, whether you have resistance concerns in the field, you know, what the environment is doing, like you said, precipitation, temperature, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, the solubility of these herbicides. Yeah. So definitely, they're not all the same, right? They're sprayed liquid, but their solubility as they go through their profile is totally different based on active ingredient, right?
Vastly different, yeah.
And what you binds got precipitation
to,
as
yeah,
well.
And what binds to residue versus not. And yeah, so it's vastly different. Now, if we're going to make some real general assumptions, right, I generally say, as we get into warmer temps in what I'll call the typical growing season, right, when people are applying pre's, you know, if we get a solid 3 weeks out of something, we're doing really well.
Right.
You know, if we're truly trying to overlap a residual where we never let anything get out of the ground, I typically tell guys you're wanting to go back in about 2 weeks to 17 days after that first one and spray a next residual,
sure.
Right? If you're not trying to get anything out of the ground, that's kind of the timing you need to be. Now, if we push it earlier and we're in some cooler, wetter temperatures, generally speaking, that extends our length of residual a little bit.
Okay.
So maybe we stretch it to 4 weeks or so.
Is that because like microbes are breaking some of this down or what's the
Generally, and sometimes just having the moisture in the soil when it's a little bit cooler, wetter, it just helps kind of keep it in solution and activated.
Oh, sure.
Right.
Okay.
So it's a mixture of various things. It doesn't break down as easy, but also just that it's in solution, ready to activate to get uptake and kind of thing. So
yeah, what, you know, kind of common questions, I guess we're areas where, you know, think about residuals, where we have issues where they kind of fail, right? Is it, you know, we're not hitting half an inch of rain? Is it dry? Is it, you know, photo degradation? You know, what are kind of those scenarios where, you know, we start thinking about, okay, I think maybe the residual failed, you know, this is probably why it did, or maybe we have some concerns that it maybe didn't activate or provide that protection that we need.
Yeah, so you know, I'd say there's three main things that you could at least think about when you have a residual that you feel like failed, right? Mm-hmm. So the first one you mentioned, photo degradation. The vast majority of the time, I'm not very concerned about that, unless it's one of our yellow herbicides, so the Prowls of the world, the Treflans of the world, which I'm not sure how much of that gets sprayed anymore, you know, nowadays.
Organic, maybe? I don't think that, right?
But so those are highly, you know, photodegradable, unless you incorporate them in. You know, dual can photodegrade, that's metolachlor, but it's still pretty good. I mean, you know, 14 days or so, so it's not normally a major concern. There's the resistance factor. So we talk a lot about PPO-resistant water hemp out there. I will say we don't necessarily – we always do resistance testing from a post-emergent standpoint. But generally speaking, we've seen that if you have post-emergence resistance, you at least have somewhat of a residual pre-emergence resistance. So for PPOs, for example, we may have, you know, complete failure post. Pre will still get some activity, but maybe it's 60%. Or instead of 3 weeks of control, now it looks like you only get 10 days to 2 weeks of control, right? And so that's kind of what you would see on a resistance standpoint. And then the last thing I would mention, though, like you brought up, is getting it activated, right? So a lot of these residuals need a pretty good slug of precipitation to truly get activated. There's a range, you know, some only need a quarter of an inch, some need up to a half an inch to three quarters of an inch even. What's interesting is I actually worked with Austin Pearson in the climate office, and I had him this year. I need to write up a little article about this yet, but I had him go through two different locations in the state and look at the probability from 20 years of past data, historical climate data, the probability of getting a half an inch of rain within 7 days, right? So try and get a herbicide activated. As you get later in the summer, like you'd expect, our chances go down. So, for example, here just outside of town at TPAC, in April, we normally have about a 60% chance of getting a half an inch of rain within 7 days. By the time we get to July, it drops down to like a 55% chance or so. What was really interesting for TPAC right here in central Indiana, we at the second half of May and the first half of June, so a whole month's time frame there, the second half of May to the first half of June, the likelihood of getting a half an inch of rain within that window dropped all the way down to 50%, 49 to 50%. So it's basically a coin toss of us getting those residuals activated if we spray them in that time. Now, if you go into southern Indiana, that, like we did CPAC, CPAC has a lot higher likelihood of getting our residuals activated. So it varies in the state, but man, to see that window, like I said, the end of May to beginning of June, where it just plummeted on our chances of getting that activating rainfall, that makes a lot of sense as to why I've heard some things, you know, particularly like dual. A lot of people tell me that one fails on them. Well, that needs a little bit more rainfall. And if we don't, if we have a coin toss chance of getting it, it seems why that might be failing on us in some of those applications.
We've kind of seen that, you know, the last couple of years. You know, we get to late May and June, the faucet shuts off. Yeah. We've had some dry late Mays and dry Junes the last couple of years.
And that's a huge window, you know, not always necessarily for our upfront residual application, but when we're trying to do some of those overlapping residuals, right, or a late shot of atrazine, that's kind of a real main window there of where we're trying to get on kind of our last application, or you know, that secondary application. And if we're just kind of not getting any activation at all, it's a tough sell then at that point.
See, I've just been enjoying watching this. You guys have really kind of handled this thing.
You know, when you have someone that can carry a conversation, this is what happens.
It's
there.
Fantastic. We should bring guys like this in more often, you know.
Yeah, so we don't have to give information, right?
Or replace you guys.
There you go.
No, I mean, it's interesting that you talk about, you know, needing the activation and going through and doing all this, because, you know, as Sean, you know, we always do a mic check before we start doing this to make sure I can hear everyone, because, you know, Dan here has this thing about turning the microphone off. That's why I put the mic flag on there so he can't reach the button. We did a podcast once where he literally turned his mic off and I didn't have the headphones on, so we couldn't hear him.
And what was the problem with that?
Maybe none. We'll let the listeners be the judge of that. But Sean always says, what do you say?
Soybeans rule and corn drools.
And you said?
Weeds win.
They always do, right? They grow in anything. So, you know, even in that dry stuff, the weeds grow anyway. So
they become tougher to kill at that point, too, because they just get hardened off and the cuticles get thick. It's tough to get our post-emergence products in then, too. So, yeah, just constant out-competing our crops, basically.
So, see, I think there's some real breeding going on in the weed science. They're doing this on purpose so they have job security. Oh, you need a half an inch within 7 days for pre's to work, and then I need 80-degree weather with, you know, 60% humidity so this can be taken up. I mean, all these
things.
They
keep the rates a little bit on the low side, build that resistance potential up.
Yeah. We all have to justify our jobs some form or fashion.
So. You know, nitrogen for us, right? That's job security for me.
Sounds to me like Sean is just a little jealous. Like, he hasn't figured it out yet. He's calling Dan out on it for nitrogen management. You for, you know, I
mean, That's all right. I'm just Sean's in the corner.
Sean's just
kicking
still
the
trying
dirt.
To,
it's like, dadgummit.
He's just still trying to figure out how to justify his job.
That seems about right.
Ouch.
Hey, let's take a time out here on the Purdue Crop Chat. And when we come back, we're going to start throwing Tommy some of the hard stuff. So when we come back, more with Tommy High Road Butts. here on the Purdue Crop Chat from Hoosier Ag Today.
I'm Matthew Chapman, and I farm in Henry County, Indiana. Indiana Soybean Alliance and Indiana Corn Marketing Council invest checkoff dollars into building demand for corn and soybeans internationally. I've seen this work firsthand, and it's been eye-opening to see the growth in these markets, which also brings dollars back to our farms. Promoting U.S. corn and soybeans and increasing global demand is critical to the success of farmers right here in Indiana.
This message is brought to you by the Indiana Soybean and Corn Checkoffs.
Back on the Purdue Crop Chat, Eric Pfeiffer here, Dan Corn Quinn, Soybean Shot Castile, Tommy High Road Butts. And Tommy was just sharing something. We have to share it on here. This is something that after over 20 years in radio now, I've dealt with this, Tommy. This is something that I hear quite often, and I never know how to take it either. People say your voice doesn't quite match what I see here, and I never know whether to take that as a good or bad thing. But you had this experience. You've been on the Purdue Crop Chat before, and someone told you this, but they were very specific about it, but still not quite sure exactly how to take it. Share the story, please, because this person may be listening, and maybe they can be a little bit more specific next time. Go ahead.
I want to thank you, because this is a great story.
This is a fantastic story. I love this. Go ahead. And I hope that this person meets me someday and they tell me something similar. I'd love to know. Go ahead, Tommy. This is good.
Yeah, so last year after I joined the Purdue podcast for the first time, I was at one of the Purdue Field Day events, basically, and someone came up to me and said, hey, it's great to put a face to the voice, but I just got to tell you that your face and voice just don't match. And then he proceeded to tell me, yeah, your voice sounds like Pocket Protector, and your face looks like Go Grab a Wrench. So I'm still not sure if that's a good or a bad thing or what that is, but that's fine.
It's quite the contrast. Yes.
Again, I want to see the Pocket Protector with a crescent wrench in it this field day season.
I'd love to know what they would say about Sean. I mean,
oh, they've already said plenty, probably.
They don't say those things to his face.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, they can't.
Tommy, I told you this before the podcast that I was going to ask you about this, and you've had time now to prepare for this question. Mm-hmm. There have been reports. We reported on it at Hoosier Ag Today, and you saw it at HoosierAgToday.com. There are reports from Bayer that they may no longer be producing glyphosate. And I just have to ask, what would that mean for Indiana, Indiana farmers and farmers around the country, around the globe? I mean, this has to be a bit of a hit.
Yeah, I mean, it would be it'd be hugely detrimental. You know, I'm sure we have to do some research into what the economics and everything would look like down the path here. But at least from a weed science standpoint, you know, we talk a lot about glyphosate resistance and how, you know, we've lost, you know, the effectiveness on certain things. But man, glyphosate is still really good on a lot of different weeds. And it's in probably just about every single mix that we have in soybeans and corn, you know, to basically knock out grasses, knock out some other, you know, general broadleaf stuff that we just don't want to deal with. And it's just, it's a great herbicide at a low use rate, and you can't really say enough good things about it, honestly, for, you know, how effective it is for our weed management and for how economical it's been for as long as it has been. So it just kind of checks all the boxes. So it'll be really tough to lose that if that is fully the case. Now, it doesn't mean that we would completely lose glyphosate, right? It would be Bayer that is shutting down their manufacturing in the United States. Depending on trade wars and other things, you know, imports could still very likely be impacted too, but we still should have supply somewhere. But what that does, you know, to the cost, instead of being, you know, $3 to $5 an acre, maybe all of a sudden Roundup becomes a $20 an acre treatment, mm-hmm. which would be just crazy to think about, you know, back mm-hmm. to those COVID prices that everybody mm-hmm. was upset about, but now it would be the standard for good. So, it'd be detrimental to the pocketbook for sure. It would also severely change what our weed control looks like as far as recommendations, what herbicides we need to get out there, and really what we need to, we would have to completely shift what our, you know, overall level of control expectations looks like. You know, Roundup gives us 100% on a lot of weeds, and there's a lot of options that won't get us 100% anymore. So that it would have to be a whole shift in mindset as well.
Well, it's been interesting. You already made the comment about how we're having to overlay multiple layers of residuals, right, and multiple passes. And, you know, it'd be fun to kind of look at the history of, okay, how many times have you, soybean producer, applied a pre and a post, and how many times that's changed? So, like, you go pre-1996, right? It was prowl pursuit days, and that was pretty heavy in the level of control. And then we've got glyphosate-resistant weeds, we've got other ones, but then it's like, okay, now we're in this pre, we're in a two-pass post system. It's like, okay, we're back to pre-1996 kind of conditions. And then to throw now a glyphosate potentially out of the mix, I mean, boy, do we go back to pre-1990s kind of weed control, right? That's a big issue there.
Right, and it's going to change probably a lot of the weeds we're dealing with in various fields. So I've seen before, I like to say that if you don't want to have a water hemp problem, let your grass go, right? Because grasses can take over a field in a hurry and choke out some water hemp. Well, now all of a sudden, if we don't have, you know, the glyphosate in the mix, we might just shift to a huge grass problem that's sucking us down. And honestly, at times, grasses can take down, especially our corn crop, a whole lot worse than maybe what a water hemp could do. So there's massive shifts that could occur there from multiple standpoints.
Well, and again, this is the sky is falling kind of mentality right now. But I mean, you think about it, there are some other opportunities. That's why we bring you on, because, you know, you bring the high road to us.
Well, again, second most negative agriculturalist. All right. It's just down all the time. I don't know if we should do the high road. It's really kind of like the low road or something here.
Down in the trenches, right?
Yeah, the dirt road, the low dirt road. I don't know what it is, but it's, yeah.
If this was to come, right, you think about grasses and the soybean crops, like, oh, we can manage that, but we also would have to think through the grass herbicides we have. They don't act in the same way that a glyphosate does, right? I mean, it's going to be a slow kill. It's going to be it doesn't look like it's doing anything for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Fops and dims that are out there, they do a good job, but it's just not going to look the same if this is the road we go.
Well, and they're much more, you know, temperature dependent. Yep. We talked about that. They're much more how do I want to say? They're basically more reliant on the tank mixtures,
sure.
Or sensitive to the tank mixtures, right? Yep. So we always talk about the group ones and auxins mixing, right? Yep. So Enlist and clethodim together isn't always a great option because they like to antagonize each other. So then we get into all that conversation, which can be troublesome. Sure. So whereas glyphosate, you throw it in the tank with just about anything and you're good to go for the most part.
Yep. Mm.
Tommy, last week I asked this question. You bring up, you know, tank mixes and everything else. We were talking about some of the things that can be cut. You know, what are the extras this year? And as folks kind of watch their bottom line this year, I asked about adjuvants and how they fix into the whole economic equation. And I think, Sean, I don't know where you pulled it from, maybe somewhere back here, but you said that's something we should ask Tommy. So
if I can't answer it, I deflect.
Yeah. So here you are. I'll ask you, you know, how do those fit into the equation? Is it, you know, certain, types of things, adjuvants work well? Do we find that across the board they work well? Where does it fit into the weed control program?
Yeah. So, you know, I have a hard time saying that you can just completely cut adjuvants out of the mix, you know, for trying to save money, right? Mm-hmm. So adjuvants do a lot of different things for us. They help maybe ease some tank compatibility issues. In the case of like AMS, they help with our hard water concerns that we have out there to condition that and make sure that our herbicides are fully active in the tank. Some of them just help get herbicides to stick on a plant better and stay on a plant or penetrate into the leaf better. So they do a whole load of different things for us. Now they're highly variable and different herbicides require different adjuvants. And a lot of times they'll have that on the label, you know, which specific ones they recommend to maximize that herbicide's effectiveness. You know, I'll generally say I tend to be kind of a bare bones guy for the most part. Like, I think we can get away with, and especially in a lean year, you know, get away with just a standard oil or a standard surfactant that's an 80-20, right? That not these heavy loaded mixes that are trying to do it all at times. I think we can get away with some of the more bare bones adjuvants and do just as well at times. But again, to scrap them completely is definitely something I wouldn't recommend, especially when we were talking about, like, you know, some of the drier conditions we get into, maybe more in the middle of the summer when those weeds start to get hardened off or stressed or other things. Adjuvants play a huge role at that point to try and just get that herbicide into stressed plants too. So they play a big role. I would say just maybe try and look around and use some products that maybe aren't the loaded down, you know, do it all type product kind of thing.
Anything else that, you know, from a weed perspective in this lean year, and maybe, I don't know, who knows how many more lean years we have, that you can recommend here to folks?
Yeah, you know, I always hate trying to recommend things, because there's what's going to get you, you know, good weed, solid weed control, and then there's what's the cheapest option, and they do not go hand in hand by any means. And weeds are always tough. I like to say, you know, we're the tougher ones between the bugs and the diseases, because they have a winner that gets rid of their problems in a lot of cases, right? Mm-hmm. Well, weeds, they don't care that we have a winner, right? They just go dormant, and then their seed bank is still there year after year. So if we have a whole lot of, you know, escapes in one year because we were trying to be lean, well, we just filled up our seed bank, and now we're dealing with it for another 10 years or longer, right?
So this is where you bring in your job security, though, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, see? We're needed for complete future because we're filling up our weed seed banks out there.
There you go.
But so it's tough to try and get lean on the herbicide front because of that longevity type thing to the seeds. I will say what I try and tell everyone, and when I was at Arkansas before being at Purdue, we did some economic analysis on some of this. Spending the money on residuals up front tends to always pay off by the end of the year. It seems more expensive. You know, our residuals tend to on the surface, be a more expensive product. But if we're using our full rate residuals, it, in all of our research, has shown that by the time we get to the post-emergence, we have a whole lot less weeds we're dealing with. And we're more effective with our post-emergence products at that point because we just have less that we're dealing with. And we can play more games then. And if we're trying to do two posts, or maybe we don't need to do two posts, or maybe we can do some other things there, we can play more games because we've effectively eliminated a massive flush up front. So that's the one thing I try and tell everybody is get your residuals out, your full rates. It seems expensive up front, but 9 times out of 10, by the end of the year, if you go back and calculate everything, you've actually saved money versus if you tried to hit it with 2 or 3 posts and you get some revenge sprays, you know, at the end for harvest aids or whatever else. Normally, all of those posts add up and make it worse for the wear on the economics front.
Yeah. So, Tommy, I did want to ask this one question. Had a couple calls on this, you know, talking about 28, right? So a lot of farmers, you know, I've had, you know, hey, I couldn't get, you know, some, they like a little bit of, you know, urea or something. They couldn't get in the field pre-plant, and now they're like, okay, I got, again, early conditions. We got the crop planted. You know, I like to get, don't have starter on my planter. I'd like to get some N out there for that crop. You know, we talked about, you know, putting 28 in, you know, a lot of applications where we put 28 in the sprayer and spray it on the crop. You know, we understand, you know, up to a certain amount, you can do, you know, 20, 30 gallons per acre and you know, it'll bang the crop up a little bit, but it'll come back. But, you know, one of my concerns with some of those questions is because a lot of times I like to do it with a herbicide, you know, and it, in some cases it can heat up the herbicide and the effectiveness of the herbicide. What are some of the cautionary pieces of doing that or having that application, especially if you're going to approach it with a herbicide mix?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've got a couple of those calls too. You know, first and foremost, I'll just always say revert back to the label, because the label tends to tell you that, you know, some of those things, whether you can or can't mix UAN or what those use restrictions are. So because it is definitely variable by active ingredient.
Sure.
But just as an example, so dual magnum, right? You can mix it with UAN, but if the corn crop is up, you definitely do not want to do that, because you're just going to light the world on fire, right? It's going to be matchsticks out there if you're lucky.
Yeah.
I generally will say, you know, normally if it's kind of a liquid type herbicide, you generally tend to be a little bit safer mixing it with UAN. If it's an oil-based adjuvant, so the duals of the world that are more oil-based, that's where you're going to see a ton of extra burn, and just you're going to probably want to avoid it from the most part. But again, the labels will guide you for sure on some of those things, so check that out. Or our weed control guide that we have have through Purdue Extension as well. It's a good selling point, right? I'm a company man. So sell that handy guide out there. We've got a bunch of that information as well, too. Yeah. You can get some of those things. But yeah, just once the crop is up and we're trying to do some of those UAN carrier applications, mm-hmm. there's some herbicides totally fine with and doesn't necessarily always affect weed control, right? Like it, we don't normally see antagonism issues for the most part. But then there are some that it's just, do avoid at all costs.
Sure.
So we've kind of bounced around a little bit from the pre's, the early planted soybeans to, okay, go into the post, get adjuvants. And I'm bringing it back a little bit here with what's coming over the next week to 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Temperatures look really good, right? I think that we're in a good spot there. But I want to throw back, if someone's not hitting the mark on temperature, what is that break point? I think about actively growing weeds or CRI or anything like that. So, again, what is your rule of thumb for good night temperatures, good day temperatures to get a good burn down, good kill, and actively growing at this point of the year?
Yeah, so my general rule of thumb for temperatures is that we want to have at least, daytime temperatures 50 to 55 degrees consistently for, 5 days to a week straight. Sure. And then you can't be freezing at night, because if you're frosting and freezing at night, all of our stuff is shutting down, right? Sure. It's not trying to actively grow. Even if you're getting up to those temperatures in the day, it still knows it's just too cold for it to come out because it's going to die off, sure. right? So definitely not freezing at night and then having that 50 to 55 degrees for at least a week. And normally that gets us into a pretty solid window.
So not as concerned if we get 40s in the night or 50s?
No, if at least at night, if we're dropping into the 40s, mid 40s, that kind of thing, not a super major concern, especially for the weeds that we're dealing with right now. Sure. The winter annual junk, they'll grow through that. They like those temperatures.
Right.
If we were talking water hemp, that's maybe not as good for that, but normally we're not in those temperature windows right now. And as I say, I looked at some of the weather forecasts both for northern Indiana down to southern Indiana. Like you said, in the next couple of weeks, it looks
really
pretty
good.
Solid.
I agree.
Anything else for Tommy here, guys? I mean, we don't get him that often.
I don't know. We might have to have him back. It's been a lively discussion. We'll bring in Chad or something from AgEcon or Michael.
Yeah.
We'll be all right.
Yeah. We get a very sad podcast. Very down in the dumps podcast.
I don't know, but we'll enjoy it. He is on the high road. So.
He is on the high road.
The dulcet tones of Purdue Crap Show podcast.
Your face doesn't match your sound at all.
I do have a face for radio, I have been told many a time. As we do get deeper here and the forecast does get better, I imagine that next week and the week after we'll see that 2% and 3% planting progress increase substantially. Yep. What advice do you guys have, corn and soybean guys? I don't know your titles either. What advice do you guys have, Dan?
This time of year is
plant
just
soybeans.
Never.
Figure out all the problems on the planter before you go in your corn. I get it. Because we can withstand all the extremes.
Yep, exactly. Figure out what doesn't work with the soybeans, and then you get it just right with the corn.
The diva crop.
So, but no, it's this time of year is just paying attention to detail. We reiterate this point over and over again that you're doing everything you can at this point to set that crop up for success. And if you have issues this time of year, whether it be compaction or starter fertilizer issues, it gets too hot on you, anything that, can cause issues, just even that first radical root, right? If it comes out of that seed and it goes into an environment it does not like, it just, that corn crop will either one, die, or just be set up for failure the rest of the year. Corn is sensitive, as Sean alludes to. But
there's no alluding.
I don't think he alludes to it. I think he flat out says it. Yeah.
Yes. it's paying attention. It's, every time you're in the heat of planting, right, you're jumping from field to field and trying to do everything as fast as possible. But, it's always good to just get out of the tractor, pay attention to the furrow, pay attention to this planting. How's the depth? Is it getting into moisture with the depth? There's all these aspects, downforce, row cleaner set, is my starter good? I'm not getting too hot on me. And there's just so many things that you have to pay attention to and pay attention to that detail. And doing everything you can to set that crop up for success this time of year is really important.
I wouldn't have given you such a hard time today, but you decided to wear a Cubs hat in here.
I did, yeah. That's, I'm a I'm a Tigers fan at heart, but, you know, my...
Oh, that's even worse. You're muted. I'm a Southsider. I know. That's bad. It's bad right now. No, you're still muted. I'm done with you.
I'm a Brewers fan, so it's not helping me over here either.
I'm Cardinals, so here we go. We're going to have a nice debate.
I mean, I can live with those, but I'm a White Sox fan. It's just, it's not going well for me right now. But
hey,
I'm not.
You guys got a record last year.
Yeah. How about that?
Records are good, right?
Yeah, records are fantastic.
What kind of record was that, Eric?
Yeah.
Let's put you on hot spot.
They're meant to be broken is what they are.
down low, right?
Yeah. You want to talk about a somber podcast, we can do that. Sean, how about you? Yeah, I can't even hear your laughs right now, Dan. Go ahead, Sean.
Soybeans planting dates stand establishment, right? These next couple weeks are going to be a great opportunity. Again, we're April 22nd already. We got the next couple days look promising to get a lot of beans in the ground. I think the following 7 days after it, the weather looks good, good temperatures. The thing I continue want people to look at is look at their seed tags. We've got some low germ lots out there, so just be mindful of that. We do have some germ lots that are 80%, 85%, so maybe some adjustments there on seed rates. And even selecting which varieties you're putting out if you're going to push. I think the planting conditions are good, but I mean, it's still April, right? And so if you're putting out beans and you've got a choice between a lot that's 90% with probably good vigor versus an 80%, I'm probably going to 90% all day long. Make sure we're making those selections. Stand establishment is going to be huge on the soybean front. We do want to start clean to play catch up in terms of any kind of weed control. That's not a good day, right? And I want to make sure that we catch up with good weed control. And then if there's any fertility that's out there, a lot of people that like to play the game with the sulfur, it's not every field that we got across Indiana or the Midwest, but certainly I want to plant timely. So if we haven't got out the sulfur applications in the March time period and you still want to do that, plant timely, get those beans out there. They're going to get that advantage of an early season growth, get more nodal development before we get into photo period. And then the next slug of field conditions for sulfur applications would be just fine.
Tommy, final advice from you today?
Well, just don't let weeds win, right? That's maybe how we got to conclude it. No, I think we kind of covered everything, right? It's using our residuals effectively, keeping the sprayer close to the planter as much as possible, and just keep fighting.
Tommy, high road butts on the Purdue Crop Chat. And soybean Sean Castile, Dan Cubs Quinn. That does it for us on this edition of the Purdue Crop Chat. We'll do it again soon, with or without Dan. We'll find out. And we'll catch you again sometime soon here on the Purdue Crop Chat from Hoosier Ag Today.
This has been Purdue Crop Chat, a regular series featuring Purdue Extension's Dr. Dan Quinn and Dr. Sean Castile, made possible by the Indiana Corn and Soybean Checkoffs, the Indiana Corn Marketing Council, and the Indiana Soybean Alliance. The Checkoffs are pleased to help bring you agronomy insights from Purdue Extension. Opinions on the podcast are those of the host and guests and not those of the sponsor. Purdue Crop Chat is a service of Purdue University Extension and Hoosier Ag Today. Timely, relevant, credible.